I can't remember a day this past 6 or 7 weeks when the front pages of our papers did not feature a headline about some incident in the West Bank. Israeli soldiers killed an Arab youth, 11 wounded in rioting in Nablus. Now, I don't in any way question the fact that these incidents took place. There have been fairly well orchestrated demonstrations throughout the West Bank and Gaza ever since the Israeli government began a program of transferring power over the local communities to village councils, who are at loggerheads and have traditionally been at loggerheads with the mayors of the major towns in the area. What I do wonder about, however, is the space and the importance which is given to these reports. After all, in the last month and a half, thousands have died in the spring offensive of the Iranians against the Iraqi forces, and that hardly made the same kind of news. Hundreds have died in the hills of Guatemala as the insurgent force tries to cut out for itself a local base of operation, and there's hardly been any real coverage of these events. The war continues in Afghanistan, apparently the yellow rain, and certainly the destruction by the Russians of whatever guerrilla bands they can come across. In Africa and Uganda, Angola and elsewhere, there are reports of tribal wars, but they hardly merit an inch or two of space. And yet when a few Arab teenagers burn a few tires on the road between Ramallah and Shechem, or when the students at Birzeit University throw rocks at Israeli policemen and soldiers, and these do what needs to be done to keep open the roads and to protect themselves, it becomes a front page day after day news. Some of this, of course, is simply the fact that it's hard for the reporters to get to the hill country of Guatemala, or the fact that they can't get at all into the battle zones of Iraq-Iranian war, and they can't get into Afghanistan, and so they report what's available to them. In part, it has to do with the fact that there are very few parts of the world where the press is free to go and to report everything they can see and come across. In most countries of the third world, and certainly within the communist world, the press is rigidly restricted. And we hear only what the government censorship allows us to hear. It's probably also true that Israel is a very convenient place for reporters to be. You can go, photograph the incident, and return to your bar in your hotel all in a matter of a few hours and spend a comfortable night in an air-conditioned room. So when all of these explanations have been given, I suspect that there's a good bit of viciousness in what we have been observing. There are still many in the world who believe that Jews should know their place and who can't make their peace with the fact that Jews have a place of their own. And being in favor of Palestinian liberation or Palestinian nationalism is a nice way to, for some, to get rid of, to discharge effectively their anti-Jewish feelings without speaking the words which could be labeled as anti-Semitic. You're allowed to be anti-Semitic in the second world and the third world, but in the free world it's still frowned on. Memories of Hitler and the Holocaust are still very vivid. And so it's easy enough to simply pick up the Palestinian cause, and I don't mean to diminish by saying this, that the rights which are properly theirs, to pick up the Palestinian cause as a rod with which to beat Jews in Israel, and to feel very virtuous in the doing. Now, what has been happening in the West Bank these last weeks has to be understood in perspective. And since the West Bank problem is going to continue, whatever I say, whatever we feel, to make the headlines over the next months and years, I'd like to spend a little time with you providing some background so that you'll have the perspective to understand the snippets of news which appear in the paper and to answer the questions which are addressed to you by neighbors and friends. One thing we must remember is that the background of these last demonstrations is the fact that though the West Bank is what the West likes to call occupied territory, a term which needs to be understood better than and more clearly than it is understood, it's a very strange kind of occupied territory. In 1967, when the Jordanian government, against the advice of the Israelis who pleaded with them not to enter the war, entered the war, and Israel quickly found its armies on the banks of the Jordan, having overrun the Jordanian troops in the West Bank, Israel proceeded to allow the West Bank community to have almost complete freedom to control its own communities. And so it's the only occupied territory I know in recent years, recent decades, where there have been free elections. Israel allowed the towns to nominate, the parties to nominate whoever they wanted for town council and town mayor, and for men to be elected to these offices, even though they were known sympathizers of the Palestine Liberation Organization. And even though the Palestine Liberation Organization made no secret of the fact that their purpose was to destroy the existence of Israel as a state. Now, the free elections were in part a conceit, because they were free in the sense that the occupying power did not intrude, but they were not free in the sense that the PLO did not intrude. Money was sent in. People were bought, votes were bought, but more importantly, guns were sent in, and people were frightened out of the electoral lists, and those who opposed the PLO candidates often found their houses bombed, their car, or they themselves a subject of assassination or assassination attempts. Now, I do not mean by this that those who became the mayors in a number of the towns of the West Bank who were or are sympathizers of the PLO might not have been on their own elected to that office. No group likes to see its own power limited. No one likes to absorb defeat. But I do mean to say that Israel began the occupation of the West Bank with high hopes that by maintaining the systems of justice and of government in place that had been in place, it might be able to provide those who live on the West Bank with the most enlightened form of government that an occupying power had given to any such group in the history of the world. And in point of fact, the conditions in the West Bank were far more prosperous, freer, and more just in the early years of the Israel occupation than they had been during the many years of Jordanian occupation. In recent months, the Israelis claim that they have found the existence of a plan for mass riots and the destabilization of the area immediately following the April 25th date, which is, as you know, the date when the final withdrawal from the Sinai is to take place. And they say that they moved in with the act which precipitated this most recent set of circumstances, the deposal of three of the mayors of the West Bank from office, in order to forestall this riot and these actions, because these three mayors were the key, the linchpin to the strikes and to the tumult and the chaos which was to be sown. Whether the Israelis were right in their judgment that it was better to forestall the attempted rebellion and to take whatever consequences had to be taken now or to have waited till it erupted, no one can say. I doubt that in terms of the press of the world or editorial comment in the world, it would have made any difference. As far as the West Bank and Gaza are concerned, it's clear that Israel can do no right. The West has determined that Israel must withdraw, that there must be a Palestinian state, and anything short of that carried out with immediacy will fail to satisfy those who think they know what is best for stability and peace and justice in that part of the world. Let's step back a moment. Let's try and understand the background and the context of all that's been happening. In 1917, the British government published the famous Balfour Declaration, which spoke of the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Palestine had been, for the preceding 400 years, an area south of Syria, which was governed out of Syria, out of Baghdad, as a province and included all that is today Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. In 1922, the League of Nations gave to Great Britain a mandate over the area in order to carry out the terms of the Balfour Declaration. Almost immediately upon having been granted that mandate, the British government announced in 1925 that Palestine was to refer only to the territory west of the Jordan River, and that their chosen Arab sheikh, whom they had brought up to govern in the desert areas on the east out of Amman, would be put in some kind of puppet state power in Transjordan, as it was then called, and the Hashemites were to rule this as a monarchy. Conditions remained essentially that until the end of the Second World War. England, at that point in 1946, handed over Transjordan, lock, stock, and army to the Hashemite king, to Abdullah, and gave him Major Jubb to govern, to organize the famous Arab Legion, a great deal of money to purchase modern weapons and set them up in grand style. Transjordan became Jordan. England, which had long since found herself opposed to the Balfour Declaration, which she herself had promulgated, and the terms of the mandate, which she herself had accepted, England, which had limited immigration into Palestine throughout the years of such desperate need, the 1930s and 40s, continued to patrol the coast of Palestine against Jewish so-called illegal immigration, against the 2 million displaced Persians, Jews, who languished in camps years after the war in Europe. And finally, when the home front said that she could no longer keep a large army in Palestine, they wanted the boys home, and when England was finding that the cost of maintaining that army was more than her treasury could manage, she tried to disarm the yishuv, the Jewish settlers. She gave arms to the Arab group, and she turned the whole problem over to the United Nations. In November of 1947, the United Nations voted a partition resolution. The partition resolution essentially said that three areas of Palestine were to be an Arab state, the area which we call the West Bank, Gaza, and a small area in the Galilee, which runs from Acre through Nazareth, and that the Galilee, the Mediterranean plain, and the Negev were to become a Jewish state. Jerusalem was to be a corpus separatum, a separate community under international rule. We must remember then that the Jews accepted the idea of a Palestinian state as long ago as 1947. There would be a Palestinian state in being if the Arabs had in fact accepted that decision of the United Nations in 1947. But they quickly announced that they would not accept anything less than all of Palestine, These were the years in which Iraq and Syria and Egypt were shouting that they would drive the Israelis into the sea, they would drive them back to Europe. War broke out, and when the war was over, Israel had by and large maintained the territory allotted to it in the partition decision, and it added to it the area in the north, which was to be part of the Arab state, the area between Acre and Nazareth. The Jordan had conquered what we now call the West Bank and proceeded to rule the West Bank as part of Jordan until 1967. And Egypt had gained control, sovereignty over the Gaza Strip. Now, the West Bank is an area which runs from a point about 15 miles north of the Sea of Galilee down to a point about halfway down the western coast of the Dead Sea and runs westward to within 10 to 12 to 15 miles of the Mediterranean. It includes most of the highland of what used to be called Palestine. It includes most of the highland route, which was the ancient trade route between the Egypt through Beersheba, through Bethlehem, Hebron, Jerusalem, Nablus, Shechem, and then to the Galilee. It includes the area which was the center of the old Jewish settlements during biblical days. It's important to remember, if we want to understand some of the nationalist and religious sentiment which has now flown towards the West Bank, that it is in the West Bank that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob traveled, lived, and settled. It was the West Bank that Joshua began to conquer. It was in the West Bank that the kings of Judah governed. The lowlands were almost always in contest between Judea and the Philistines, between Judea and the Canaanites or the Phoenicians, between Judea and the Syrians, between Judea and the Romans. But the highlands, the West Bank, was almost entirely a Jewish settlement, a Jewish kingdom during all of ancient biblical times. And so the roots of our people go back to the West Bank far more than they do to the area which we now call the State of Israel. The West Bank consists of about 2,270 square miles. It has a population of about 750,000. Of these, about 720,000 are Arabs, both Christian Arabs and Muslim Arabs, and about 25,000 are recent Jewish settlers. When Jordan conquered the West Bank, all the well-established settlements in the area which had been Jewish were overrun, and those who were not killed had to settle in new homes within the boundaries of the State of Israel. There were larger settlements in Hebron, at Kfar Etzion, and elsewhere on the West Bank. One of the things we also have forgotten about the West Bank is that during the period of Jordanian rule, the West Bank was as restive, as politically rebellious as it has been under the recent years of Israeli rule. The West Bank was then full of Nasserites and of communists and of Ba'athists and of Muslim Brotherhood people. And these people stirred up so much trouble for King Hussein that he banned all political parties. At one time, he disbanded his own parliament because it had a majority of Palestinians whom he couldn't control in it. He censored all newspapers, and he had to maintain two-thirds of his standing army in garrisons in the West Bank towns. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting and completely overlooked sidelights to the negotiations which people have been attempting as far as the West Bank is concerned is the recognition that prosperity began to come to Jordan only when Jordan lost the West Bank. It was only after Jordan lost the West Bank, only after she didn't have to maintain the large standing army there, that her own society was able to emerge and to develop its own domestic needs. And the modest prosperity which the kingdom has enjoyed in recent years and the modest security which it has enjoyed has begun. Almost immediately, you recall, after the loss of the West Bank in 1967, King Hussein felt strong enough within 3 years to move against the PLO. And in December of 1970, he destroyed the PLO in his own country and essentially, for the first time, gained effective control over his own kingdom. And if you wonder why Jordan has been unwilling to enter into negotiations through the Camp David Accord or in any other way for the West Bank, it's really because though King Hussein may have visions of sometimes being ruler of an area which stretches from Amman to the sea, his advisors know very well that security and prosperity depends upon the West Bank remaining under Israeli control. If it is an independent state under PLO control, the PLO will destabilize Amman as quickly as it will try to destabilize Jerusalem. If he must assert his control over the West Bank, he brings into his own country 700,000 and some Arabs who become his citizens, who are more numerous than the Hashemites' own Bedouins, who are the support of the realm, and ultimately he must lose out in a power struggle to them. So his role is thoroughly understandable. It is one of survival, as it always been for the king of that little kingdom. The West Bank has had a long history of turbulence and convulsion and of violence. And when in 1967 the Israelis took over the area, they too had no desire at the beginning to assert political control over the West Bank. If you remember, Levi Eshkol in 1968 offered to turn the West Bank back to the Arabs under Jordanian sovereignty if only Amman would guarantee that there would be no militarization of that area, and if he would guarantee that Jerusalem would remain undivided. It was at that time that the Arab states met at Khartoum. You remember at the famous no, no, no conference, they would not negotiate, there would be no conferences, there would be no mediation, there would be no meeting with Israel in order to adjust and to find some kind of accommodation for the problem. As late as the early 1970s, Israel was restraining those within Israel who were speaking of setting up settlements in the West Bank. They wanted to maintain the status quo ante, things as they had been, in order to ultimately use the West Bank as a bargaining chip in order to achieve peace and security with their neighbors. For Israel, the West Bank represents a problem. The problem is that if the West Bank exists as a separate state, Israel has not only much longer and much more difficult borders to defend, and not only is it true that Arab guns then could be within 10 or 12 miles of Tel Aviv and of Haifa, but it's equally true that she would have to absorb a number of 750,000 Arabs into her body politic, and with the differential in the birth rate between Arabs and Israelis, the Jewishness of the Jewish state would be threatened in very short order. And so it was quickly realized after 1967 that the best thing for the West Bank would have been to somehow return it to Jordan and to demilitarize it. But Jordan didn't want it. And the Arab states recognized a good propaganda weapon when they had one. And in Israel, changes were beginning to take place. As Israel has suffered over the 25 years of pressure, of war, as Israel has found itself frustrated in its attempt to establish some modus vivendi, some accommodation with its Arab neighbors, Israel has become more defensive, a growing sense of insecurity, a growing sense of suspicion. And then, too, Israel is part of the world. And as with other parts of the world, the resurgence and renaissance of religious orthodoxy, of religious passion, has affected Israel. And that Israel is not alone. We see that in Iran, we see that in Ireland, we see that with the moral majority in our own country. Orthodoxies of all kinds and of all stripes, cults of all kinds and of all stripes, have come to play an increasingly important role in a world which is increasingly frustrated by its inability to solve its own problems and to establish peace and some kind of economic opportunity. And Israel's not been immune. And there slowly grew in Israel pressures to return the ancient promised land, what Begin now calls Judah and Samaria, to pick up the resonances of the biblical times, to return these ancient lands somehow to an area in which Jews could live and work to become part of a Jewish state. At first, the settlements were limited to military outposts, recognizing that the Arabs were not about to accept the return of the West Bank and demilitarization. Mr. Alon and others made a series of proposals that Israel would set up a series of military stations in various key areas in the West Bank, and that the rest of the West Bank would be turned back to the Arabs to rule as they saw fit. Israel, therefore, would guarantee its security, and the Arabs would have a form of quasi-sovereignty over their own lives. But the pressure, this proposal found no response, and the pressures grew. And in Israel, we began to find groups like the Gush Emunim, the group of those who are self-styled faithful, who began to argue that the government was standing in the way of Zionism, of the Jewish ideal, of the old pioneering spirit. And they began to play on fear and on sentiment. How, they said, could Israel tolerate the fact that the only place in the world which might be by law Judenrein, free of all Jews, would be that part of the Holy Land which was most holy to Jews? By law, no Jew may be a citizen of Jordan. It was assumed by, and is assumed by the world, that if the Israelis pull back, all the settlements would have to be dismantled. How, these people said, could any self-respecting government in Jerusalem accept that state of affairs? We have the right to be wherever we have a desire, in a sense, to be wherever tradition tells us that we should be. And they cited the Bible, they cited the authority of the Jewish tradition, they cited the authority of the Zionist movement. Here were these ancient settlements. We were there. We were on the land. We were the first to go on the land. How can you abandon that land? And they went into the areas which were not being cultivated on the West Bank. They went into the old crown lands, which had been maintained in their feudal way by the king in Jordan. They bought land from those who had been peasants and small-time farmers who found it now more desirable to enter trade in the city. And little by little, these groups began to create first what were illegal settlements, and then settlements which were more or less legalized. In 1973, the Labor government, and we must remember that it's not simply Mr. Begin who has tolerated this kind of activity. The Labor government issued a paper called Galili Manifesto, in which essentially Israel said, the West Bank must not be considered as occupied territory. The actual sovereignty over the West Bank has never been decided, and our claims are as legitimate as those of any other group. Therefore, we will allow within limits the settlement by those who wish to pioneer in areas where they do not infringe upon the property rights of those already in the area. For a year or two, a number of small settlements were tolerated by the Labor government. Then, under pressure from the United States, they pulled back from this position. And when Mr. Begin came into power, to a large degree supported by those from the Gush and elsewhere who have this religious nationalist sentiment, he began to permit more of these settlements to go into place. It's important to recognize that when we talk of settlements, we're talking of 40 or 50 small villages, which in the aggregate do not number 25,000 people. We're not talking of a great mass population movement which would displace a mass of people who was already there. Under the Geneva Convention, which is often cited as the legal basis for the attack on Israel's settlement policy, the settlement by the occupiers is not prohibited. What is prohibited is the settlement by the occupiers if in so doing they displace the indigenous population. And that so far, for the most part, has not been what Israel has undertaken or carried out. In the last 3 or 4 years, however, under Mr. Begin, but largely for reasons which are extraneous to his own particular political outlook, these settlements and the whole West Bank question has become more and more significant, not only in the Near East, but throughout the world. A feeling has developed, a consensus has developed in the chanceries of the West, that if only Israel would be forthcoming on the West Bank, somehow all of the problems which face us, as far as oil, as far as markets, as far as the Arab world is concerned, would ultimately be resolved. That it's only the West Bank, and therefore only Israel, which stands in the way of an easy and free and understanding relationship between the United States and England, West Germany, France, and those countries in the Arab world who ought, according to this theory, by rights, to be our friends and our allies. And first, the European Economic Community, and increasingly this Reagan administration, and before it the Carter administration, have begun to focus their attention on the issue of the West Bank as if all of the problems in the Middle East, insofar as they affect us, would be resolved if only this problem could be resolved. Part of this goes to the very nature of the Camp David Accords. The Camp David Accords had to do with the Sinai. They had to do another protocol with the relationships between Egypt and Israel, commercial, political, and otherwise. And there was a third protocol which had to do with the establishment of some kind of negotiations over a period of time, 5 years, which would look forward to setting up the apparatus which would allow the local, the people on the scene, the Palestinians, the Jordan, and Israel, to enter into some kind of long-term arrangement as far as the West Bank and Gaza are concerned. These are the so-called autonomy talks. Autonomy was a deliberately fuzzy word chosen at Camp David in order to avoid a word which would have specific meaning. It meant essentially something needed to be done. Some control over their lives had to be given to those who live on the West Bank. But the form, the nature, the extent of that control, whether it was sovereignty or something much less, was specifically left vague because no one could agree on it. But because this is the only element in the Camp David Accord which has not been completed, Israel withdrew from the Sinai. Egypt has been less than forthcoming but has so far lived up to most of the terms of the agreement. Only the autonomy issue remains unresolved, therefore remains to be resolved. And because the Arab world, with its billions of oil-rich dollars, because the Arab world has said to the West, Israel is our enemy, this is the area where you have to prove to us your friendship. The chanceries of the West have picked up Palestinian nationalism as a favorite cause of the moment and have begun to argue that it is only the intransigence of Mr. Begin and of Likud which stands in the way of truly open, free, and understanding relationships which would be profitable for the West and which would advantage the West. Now, unfortunately, this is nonsense. The war between Iraq and Iran, the concern about the control of the Horn of Africa, the Gulf of Hormuz, the issue of the price of oil, the issue of entrance into various markets of the world, the struggles between Egypt and Libya, between Morocco and the Polisario, the problems which have to do with the unsettling of the oil-rich kingdoms by more radical groups within them, all of these issues have absolutely nothing to do with the West Bank, except in one sense, that among the radical forces operating throughout the Middle East, Palestine Liberation Organization is the organization which supplies the know-how, which trains the guerrillas which is the carrier of money from the Soviet Union, from Libya, to many of these groups. What's the solution, or is there a solution, for the West Bank? If Israel were forced to give back the West Bank under international pressure, which means under pressure from the United States, I do not doubt that there might be civil war in Israel. I believe that a majority of the Israelis might bow to force majeure, that is, to the fact that they're a small country and they depend entirely for their arms and to a large degree for markets upon the West. They might bow to the inevitable and try to make the best of it. But there is a sufficient minority in Israel who will not bow, who say, we learned in Warsaw, we learned in the ghettos of Europe, which we cannot simply bow our heads to those who would take our lives. We must fight, and fight now. This is by right, our right. There's a sufficient minority in Israel who would prevent any government from carrying out that kind of decision. You've seen the images of soldiers picking up youngsters and others from Yamit, the town in the Sinai, which is being given back, most of which is being given back to Egypt. Those who settled in Yamit knew that they would be at someday that they would be removed. And so the issue is somewhat different. But if you multiply the passion that you've seen about Yamit 10,000-fold, you'll begin to get some of the sense of anger, frustration, and even the willingness to resort to violence, which I think would occur if any government were willing to accede to that kind of pressure. So unless the United States wants to so destabilize Israel that she will lose a valuable ally in the Middle East, weaken Israel to the point, internally at least, where she might not be able to defend herself, unilateral pressures on Israel to withdraw immediately from the West Bank will not work. If she pressures Israel to withdraw and pressures Jordan to accept, she's caught in the horns of another part of the dilemma. If Jordan accepts the West Bank, she accepts within her body politic a radical government, which will be largely dominated by the PLO, and another so-called ally in the Middle East will be destabilized. If we pressure simply for a government on the West Bank, which is local, and we say there'll be some kinds of guarantees as to that it will be passive, there's absolutely no way that any government can guarantee that. Guns can be run. Arabs are noticeably volatile. Wherever the PLO has been, there has been violence. There's no guarantee that we could accomplish this end. And if we don't, the long border with Israel, the long border with Jordan will become a border through which the terrorists will infiltrate. There'll be attack and counterattack, the kind of a scene that you've seen time and again now in the Lebanon will begin to reappear in the Israeli border, provided, of course, Israel would survive politically the withdrawal and the area would go up in flames. What am I suggesting? I'm suggesting that for the moment, those who think of withdrawal and independence, Israel's withdrawal, Palestinian independence, as a quick and easy solution to the problems that are of that area are misguided in the extreme. If the proposal which they are making, proposals which I know have very wide acceptance in and out of Washington, are nevertheless proposals which fail entirely to take into consideration the reality of the situation in the field. In my humble estimation, what's needed now is a recognition by the chancelleries of the West that Israel needs time and needs reassurance. Israel has given up a piece of territory larger than the entire state of Israel. Israel has given up its only oil-producing area in the Sinai. Israel has given up an area which protected its space from direct attack from Egypt. It has done so in the hope that it could establish political, meaningful political, open commercial relationships with its major neighbor. But it's not clear that this will happen. It's not clear that after April 25th, Mr. Mubarak and the rest of the Egyptians will not move back rather quickly into the Arab camp, that you won't begin to hear again from Cairo the kinds of sounds that you heard under Mr. Nasser and during the early days of Mr. Sadat. Israel needs time to calm its fright, its fears, its nerves, to learn that an Arab country can in fact be trusted. If Israel is pressured immediately to go the next step, all the way, I'm afraid that the Israeli polity cannot accept it, neither a Labor government, nor the present, nor a future Likud government. To pressure Israel now to give up more is a recipe for convulsion from that part of the world. There needs to be time. There needs to be also some understanding by Washington and by Jerusalem of the fact that certain kinds of relationships might be possible, certain kinds of bridges might be built to the Arab population in the West Bank. The Israelis under Mr. Begin have taken a much tougher line than they took up to the present administration. There's been tougher censorship of the Arab newspapers, which incredibly can print, you know, absolutely vitriolic diatribes against Israel. There's been some new censorship of suppression on the universities. There have been time and again search and seizures which have been carried out in relatively high-handed ways. If Israel were to work with the United States and with other groups to find those people in the West Bank who will accept some local responsibility, and that's what she thought she was doing with the village councils, if she will begin to be less hard-nosed in some of her reactions to the incidents in the area, then perhaps a breathing spell can come, a breathing spell of some years, during which Israel will learn that, hopefully, that Egypt can be trusted, that in fact she could trust other countries in the world if only things might be negotiated. If when there is trust, everything is possible. When trust is lacking, only war is possible. But to accomplish this, those diplomats and administrators in Washington and London and Bonn who have made the issue of the West Bank so central are going to have to learn to tell the Arab world some very simple truths. That they are willing to buy and sell, to enter into commercial relationships with them, that they are willing to be on the most friendly of terms with them, but that they are not willing to make all of their relationships dependent upon the solution, in quotation marks, of an issue which they do not control, and which in fact ought not to be approached now because it will resound to no one's benefit. Whether they will do this, I doubt. The consensus is very strong. People have decided that it's easier to lean on Israel than to think clearly about the complex of problems which the Middle East faces. But haven't we learned that trying to placate the Arabs by giving them what they want, even when it's not in our best interest, doesn't work? I maintain that it was not in our best interest to sell the AWACS to Saudi Arabia. They were on the spot. They were doing all that they could do if they were transferred to Saudi Arabian control. It was an act simply of arrogance on the part of the Saudis to demand that they have physical control over the planes. And we went ahead, and despite the turmoil and the political unrest here in America, despite the cost in political terms, we sold the AWACS to the Saudis, and 2 days later, Saudi Arabia increased the price of oil by $2 a barrel, so that in 500 days she will have paid off the entire cost of the AWACS. And she proceeded within 2 months to reduce the flow of oil into the international market in effect, keeping up the oil drain, the dollar drain, which is so much a part of all the economic malaise which is affecting Europe and the United States and much and most of the world. The Arabs, unfortunately, like some of the Israelis, are affected now by jingoism and religious nationalism, and also, I suspect, a good bit by the fact that they've been down for so long, and by God, this is their time, and they're going to take full advantage of it, and they're going to make those old colonial powers in the West cringe and do their bidding, and they're taking a kind of perverse joy in accomplishing that. It's very human to it. But when you combine that with the fact that the Arab world has always believed that religious issues can be settled by the sword, has preached the crusade jihad very much the way the medieval church preached it, you have a recipe for fanaticism, zealotry, jingoism, which is dangerous in the extreme. More arms have been poured into the Middle East in the last 3 years than the total output of arms by all sides in the Second World War. More firepower. Or dollar cost. For what? How will they be used? Against whom will they be used? The Arab world is demanding vengeance, and it's made Israel the focus of many of these demands. And unless the West is willing to allow its policies and its economies to become captive to Riyadh, to Baghdad, Damascus, Cairo, at some point, someone is going to have to say no. You can't have it all your way. There needs to be some understanding of the Kurds, the Black Sudanese, and the Shiite minorities and Sunnite communities and Sunnite minorities and Shiite communities, and yes, even of the Jews in Israel. And only when that happens is there really any hope to disengage the issue of the West Bank from all the other issues which confront the West and the East, and to give Palestinians, Israelis, Jordanians, the people most immediately involved, the chance, the time, the decade or two. Is that sufficient trust bridges will be built so that an arrangement can be shaped which will have some lasting power and which will allow these peoples whose economic lives must be interdependent if they are to survive. Palestinians must work in Israel. Israel must sell to Palestine and to Jordan. That has to happen for these three small communities to survive. Only if there's time and only if there's trust is there any chance for that kind of resolution. Amen. We continue on page 620. Eternal God, we face the morrow with hope made stronger by the vision of your kingdom. A world where poverty and war are banished, where injustice and hate are gone. Teach us more and more to share the pain of others, to heed your call for justice, to pursue the blessing of peace. Help us, O God, to gain victory over evil, to bring nearer the day when all the world shall be one. On that day, the age-old hope shall come true. On that day, O God, you shall be one, and your name shall be one. The contemplation of death should plant within us the soul elevation and peace. Above all, it should make us see things in their true light. For all things which seem foolish in the light of death are really foolish in themselves. To be annoyed because another has slighted us or has been somewhat more successful in social distinctions, pulled himself somehow one rung higher up the ladder than ourselves. How ridiculous all this seems when we couple it with the thought of death. To pass each day simply and solely in the eager pursuit of money or fame, this also seems like living with shadows when one might take one's part with realities. Surely when death is at hand, we should desire to say, I have contributed my grain to the great store of the eternal. I have borne my part in the struggle for goodness. Let no man or woman suppose that the smallest social act of goodness is wasted for society at large. All our help, petty though it be, is needed. And though we know not the manner, the fruit of every faithful service is gathered in. Let the true and noble words of a great teacher ring in conclusion upon our ears. The growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been, is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs. Let those who now recall the death of loved ones rise and join with me in our Kaddish prayer. Yit gadal v'yit kadash shmer rabba v'yalma divrach yirutei v'yamnich malchutei v'chaye chon v'yome chon v'chaye d'chol beit Yisrael bagala v'zman kari v'imru. Amen. Yehei shmer rabba mvorach l'olam ul'olmei olmaya yit barach v'yishtabach v'yit poar v'yit romam v'yit nasei v'yit adar v'yit ale v'yit halal shmer d'kudusha b'richu Leila min kol birchata v'shirata, tush birchata v'nechemata da'amiran pa'olma v'imru. Amen. The souls of Sally Berger and Jean Eckstein, who passed away from our midst during this last week. And the souls of Cora Niebel, Dr. Joseph L. Fetterman, Max Friedman, Carl Lehman, Melvin Neuerman, Morris J. Brown, Teresa N. Bing, Isaac Nathan, Alfred A. Friedheim, Charles Graver, Ida Gamson Weitz, Samuel Newman, Sanford Weinberg, Susan Faub, Max Samuel Schiffman, Mike Rosenberg, Isidore Kutz, Martin F. DeVay, Rose Davidson, Dr. Joseph Klein, Rhea N. Heller, Isaac Evans, and Bernard H. Fried. The anniversaries of whose deaths occurred during this past week. And the souls of all whom we at this hour remember in tenderest affection, may peace and bliss be granted in the world of eternal life. These still live on earth in the acts of goodness they performed in the hearts of those who cherish their memory. May the beauty of their lives abide ever among us as a loving benediction. Yehei shalom rabba min shemaya v'chayim, aleinu v'yal kol Yisrael v'imru. Amen. Ose shalom bimromav, uya se shalom, aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru. Amen. May the Father of peace send peace to all who mourn, and may he comfort all the bereaved among us. This morning was a very lovely first. It was the first time members of the confirmation class and of parents have joined together for a service such as this. We're very grateful to Myrna Spira and Roman Freeman, who acted as co-chairman of the morning, and we're particularly happy to all those who lent their talents to this service. Roman and his daughter Laura, Myrna and her son Robbie, Jerry Rosenthal and his daughter Jennifer, and Marlene Krause, who played the flute for us so beautifully. I'm only sorry that the beauty of her playing was followed immediately by the hoarseness of my voice. On Tuesday of this week, the Temple Men's Club will have the final lunch with the rabbi uptown for the year. It will be at noon at Our Gang 2. Anyone who would like to come and talk for me, as well as with me, is invited to join. We'll talk, we usually talk about all of the problems of the world. On Friday of this week, the Temple Young Associates will have their Sabbath dinner here at 6 p.m. in the branch. And at the services next Sunday morning, at these services, I will speak on the theme, Nuclear Freeze and Nuclear Frenzy. What is all of this protest about? You will be receiving this week in the mail brochures announcing the new Temple Endowment Fund campaign. I've written about in the Temple Bulletin, as has Jim Rich, who is chairman of the campaign. We are kicking off this campaign to secure the future of the Temple with a series of seminars which focus not only on the campaign itself, but on personal financial planning. And when the brochure reaches your home, I hope you will look at it and come to one or another of these seminars. Some are during the day and some are during the evening. They're going to take place over the next 6 or 8 weeks. There's no solicitation at the seminars. They are designed to set the groundwork for the campaign and to help you understand how it might be possible for you to make a sizable gift to the temples to allow us to continue in the future the same level of services which we've been able to render in the past. The campaign will last for a considerable length of time, but it's important that it begin and begin well. And so I hope that you will come to one or another of these seminars, that you will send back the little white card which is in the brochure indicating which of the seminars you wish to attend. And now will you rise and join with me in the final benediction. Lord our God and God of our fathers, we ask peace for our people and for all peoples. We ask for the understanding which will allow peace to develop and to emerge. We hope that the world will learn to be patient with the needs, the fears of those who are small, and to remember that what seems so simple when one is looking only at one's own interests can be complex and difficult and even suicidal when seen by those whose lives we are manipulating and determining. Be, O Lord, with this thy people, with the family and all whom they love. Encourage them in their labors, inspire them in their undertakings. And may all of us find in our lives, within ourselves, the peace that we seek for our world. Boachem b'shalom, seitchem l'shalom. As your coming was in peace, so may your going be unto peace. Amen.